We are back with another episode of The Europeans, the podcast about stuff that has been happening roughly from Ireland in one direction to Turkey in the other. And my usual co-host, Dominic Kramer, is away singing again. That man does not stop working. But luckily for me, my other favourite Amsterdammer is here to keep me company, producer Katz Laszlo. Hi, Katz.
Yay, hello.
How are you doing?
I've been hiding from the world and just looking out the window, so I don't have much to say about that.
Strong early 2025 vibes there.
How about you?
I'm good. I'm actually feeling quite proud of myself. I faced one of my great fears over the weekend.
Which is?
Koi carp. You know, the like giant goldfish.
Why are you so afraid of koi carp? They're so jolly.
They're not really technically goldfish, but you know, those things that look like giant goldfish. So you like them?
I love them. They're so fantastically large.
I don't like them. And I went to the Paris Aquarium this weekend. And unfortunately for me, our aquarium is twinned with one in Japan. So instead of the usual open tank full of like rays that kids can touch, they've got one full of these like horrifying giant goldfish instead. But you know, I didn't want to like show my fear in front of my kids. So I bravely stuck my hand in and tried to have a good time as these horrible giant mouths came towards me.
Funny, why are you so afraid of them? What is it about them?
I don't know. I think it's like the speckly colours and just the general largeness of them. It's not right.
Strange. I recently went to a sauna complex and it was like one of these places where it's outside. And then I looked down in this pond and I thought like, no, this doesn't look like a pond you're supposed to get in. And then I saw just like one lonely, very cold looking koi. And I was like, this is so tragic.
I would not have found that relaxing at a sauna complex. That would have taken me right out of the zen mood.
Well, I like koi, so there.
Okay, well, thanks for your support in this moment of fear.
I'm proud of you.
But moving on, we have our usual smorgasbord of things to talk about in this week's show, including a very fun interview revealing all of the secrets of how the trade in TV formats works. If you've ever wondered why all of our countries have the same formats of game shows and quiz shows and reality TV shows, and even sometimes the same drama storylines transplanted into local contexts and languages, this is the interview for you. I will be speaking to probably the person who knows more about this trade than anyone else in the world, the Swiss professor Jean Chalabi. That is coming up after.
So, Katie, I have been hiding from the news, initially just the American news and now just all news.
Great. What are you doing here?
True. There's no comeback from that. But I understand that you are going to tell us a little bit about all the things I've been avoiding.
Yeah, it's a bit of an elephant in the room this week, but I'm going to give my bad week to Europe's relationship with the United States of America. This isn't exactly one of those stories that we're choosing to talk about because it hasn't received enough media coverage. Mm. Because frankly, the headlines of every media outlet around Europe are full of doom about our relationship with the US at the moment. But it does feel like something that would be good to just, you know, take a step back from and try to figure out what it all means. So I'm going to do my best to do that this week.
Thank you, Katie.
You're very welcome. I mean, frankly, if you have like Kat's been burying your head in the sand when it comes to everything to do with the US and news in general, who would blame you? So well done for being here.
I will say in my defense, I worked as a journalist in the States during his first presidency. So I'm just like, no.
The trauma is real. But I'll just give you a quick rundown of the latest things that have been happening in Trump land that specifically affect us over here in Europe, because there have been a few of them. As the former guest of this podcast and now president of Finland, Alexander Stubb, said when he was trying to sum up recent events, he said, there are decades when nothing happens and there are weeks where decades happen. And this was one of those weeks. So what happened? A couple of things. First, Trump announced new wider tariffs on steel and aluminium that affect European companies pretty badly. It's not really clear what's going to happen with that yet, but there have been plenty of verbal threats flying across the Atlantic that suggest our trade relations are not exactly headed in a friendly direction. The second big thing is that Trump announced that the US was going to start talks with Russia about ending the war in Ukraine. Now, we are recording this on Tuesday, And those talks are just getting started as we speak over in Saudi Arabia. Ukraine is not invited to these talks, and neither are European leaders. Mm. What kind of message does that send? Well, it's very early days, but at the moment, all of the early signs are that any proposal coming out of these talks is going to be focused on what a deal on Russia's terms would look like, right? These talks are about trying to figure out what Putin could be given to make him agree to stop attacking Ukraine.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine peace talks where one of the crucial parties isn't involved getting very far.
Quite. And the Trump administration have made it very clear already that, as far as they're concerned, it is okay if the price of peace includes, for example, Russia being permanently given some of the Ukrainian territory that it has taken during the war as a reward for kindly stopping its bombing of innocent people. They've also been very clear with the idea that they think it should be completely off the table for Ukraine to ever join NATO, if that's something that Putin wants, which of course, you know, he does want that, because the idea of Ukraine joining NATO, that would really symbolize Ukraine being part of the West and very much out of his sphere of influence. So yeah, it is early days, but the shape of any hypothetical deal emerging from these talks seems instinctively like it will favor Russia. And certainly Ukrainians won't be in the room, and neither will negotiators from any other European countries to try and make things any different. So that was the second big blow in the middle of last week. The same day, Trump's defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, announces on a trip to Brussels that Europe is going to have to start paying for way more of its defense costs and stop free riding off the US to defend itself.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. It's something that comes up a lot in the States, right? Like this complaint that Europe is basically not paying for its own armies and the US has to pay for defending us. Like, is that really true? Is that valid?
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those things that I think is pretty invisible to most Europeans who don't really engage with the military in any way on a daily basis. Obviously, every European country has its own national armed forces. But essentially, the US complaint is that European countries have been chronically underspending on their militaries for decades. And certainly it's true that historically, the US has spent way more on defense stuff, both people and equipment, for decades. It is the world's largest military spender. It pours about 3.4% of its GDP into this area, something like $967 billion last year,
wow,
which is a huge amount of money in, you know, actual dollar terms. But it's also very big as a percentage of the US economy. US governments have simply prioritized defense more, while European countries have been prioritizing, I don't know, you know, pouring money into our horrific socialist welfare systems and like subsidizing contemporary dance or whatever other degenerate things we apparently do over here.
Ballet or bombs.
It's a choice. But anyway, the bulk of the running costs for NATO, the Western Military Alliance, those have always been covered by the US, and there are about 100,000 US troops stationed on this continent. So hypothetically, if Russia or someone else decided to attack continental Europe right now, a lot of the resources for defending us would come from the US. And Trump, during his first presidency, he got super mad about this. I kind of think that of everything that he's done, this is one of the less unreasonable things to get mad about. You know, Europe is a big, rich continent. Why should we be dependent on the US to defend ourselves? It's a weird kind of situation. I mean, to our credit, lots of European countries have been spending more on defense since both the first Trump presidency and the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. NATO countries are supposed to spend 2% of their GDP on defense. About two-thirds of them now do that. And some of them are spending way more than 2%. Poland, for example, is spending 4%. But that isn't enough for the Trump administration. And it is now signaling that strategically, it isn't even really that interested in defending Europe anymore. It's more interested in trying to work out how to handle its rivalry with China. Europe, you know, we're big, we're rich, we should be left to our own devices, which I kind of think is fair enough. But it also creates a huge problem of how we would supposedly fill this big hole in our defense budget if the US just says to us that we're on our own now.
Yeah, that's something that's really moved. Like, my understanding has really moved in the past few years, because I was just so deeply raised with a value system that I think like a lot of Europeans have been raised with, of like, we will never do war again.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was reporting in Ukraine, then you suddenly realize like, oh, there's a huge difference between defense and attack. And like, that's a very privileged position to be in, to say like,
yeah,
weapons are all bad.
Absolutely.
Okay. So that was the second or third thing. What else?
That was the third thing. I'm now onto the last thing, I promise. Probably the biggest shock came on Friday when the US Vice President J.D. Vance gave a speech at the Munich Security Conference. It's this kind of annual defense gathering in Germany where Western leaders get together and talk about war, basically. And everyone had been expecting J.D. Vance to talk more about Ukraine and the future of the US defense relationship with Europe. But that is not what happened. What he did do is deliver this rather astonishing 19-minute ideological attack on Europe, basically shitting on our values, questioning whether Europe and the US have anything in common anymore, and telling us that as a continent, if we don't embrace Trump's ideology, we are not worth being friends with. He also accused Europe of fundamentally doing democracy wrong. He said our continent was overrun with censorship, and he accused European leaders of trying to overturn democratic elections.
Mm.
I mean, let's be clear, the bit about supposedly trying to overturn democratic elections was specifically a reference to Romania, where the first round of the presidential election got cancelled once it emerged that there'd been huge Russian interference. I too have questioned whether it was ultimately the right move to cancel this election after the fact. But I'm sorry, I mean, you MAGA people literally tried to claim that Trump won the 2020 election.
Mm.
And you're now going to come to our house and lecture us about not respecting democracy. I mean, like, the whole speech was quite stunning in its hypocrisy.
Oh, it's also just really frustrating because then like any remotely shared opinion or feeling becomes dangerous. Like, even if you feel like, oh, there's some truth in this, it's just like, it's still more important to hold your ground.
And it would be quite fair to question how much of the speech in general was really meant for us as Europeans.
Mm.
I mean, J.D. Vance is widely being talked about as having ambitions to run for president himself once Trump is done. And the whole speech did kind of feel like delicious red meat for the MAGA people following this back home. Particularly the way that it picked and chose a few slightly random European court cases to paint this weird, distorted picture of Europe as this like hellish place that's been taken over by the woke virus or whatever.
Mm.
So maybe the speech was meant to be heard at least as much back home as on this side of the Atlantic. Having said that, there were a couple of things that were particularly shocking about J.D. Vance's little trip to Europe. One is that he met with the leader of the far-right AfD in Germany, Alice Weidel.
Mm, she seems very busy with all of these American people these days.
She's taking a lot of meetings, isn't she? Apparently, at the same time, Vance decided it wasn't worth his time to meet with the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz. And while I do see the practicality of this, you know, it's very unlikely that Scholz is still going to be in power this time next week. The symbolism of the Vice President of the United States declining to meet with the Chancellor of Germany, a key ally, and instead meeting with the head of a party that is formally classified as an extremist organization, that is really quite astonishing, not least just a few days before the German elections. And it's a really clear indicator of who in Europe the Trump administration sees itself as being aligned with, seeing eye to eye with. And it is not mainstream governments. It is far-right parties.
Oh, I just, every time you say that, I'm like, oh no, the mainstream government in my country is far-right. Oh no.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's also part of the story, right? Like, not all of these parties are fringe anymore. They are becoming part of the establishment, which the Trump administration, I'm sure, is very happy to see on this side of the Atlantic. The other thing that was particularly disturbing about Vance's speech itself was the way that he talked about the threats facing Europe. He said, "The threat I worry about most vis-a-vis Europe is not Russia, it's not China, it's the threat from within." And that was when he proceeded to wang on for ages about how we're apparently doing democracy wrong over here. But even though all of that stuff was hypocritical and kind of jaw-dropping, that wasn't really the shocking thing about it. The shocking thing is that he was able to say that this apparent disagreement between the US and Europe when it comes to our values, that is more worrying to him than the threat posed by Russia. Mm. He couldn't have said it any clearer. And if you just let that sink in for a minute, how disturbing is that? I mean, Russia is a country that 3 years ago fully invaded its neighbor, totally unprovoked, with a view to taking over this country in its entirety. They have killed tens of thousands of people. And this country is apparently viewed by the new US government as less of a threat to Europe than our out-of-control woke values.
It's confusing because it's all really shocking. And on the other hand, he's just saying what we already knew he was going to say, right? Like, I mean, it just feels like we don't even live in the same universe anymore, let alone share the same values.
I mean, we don't. It's true. So to some extent, Vance was just saying out loud what everyone already knew. But the fact that he was saying this so openly, so publicly, this really feels like a public breakup. It feels like this moment where Europe has to stop thinking about the US as a friend in the world. And in practical terms, it means we really have to stop relying on the US to defend us if we get attacked.
God, I just wonder if there's going to be a moment in our lifetime where, like, the US just becomes a normal country because of all of this, rather than this huge superpower.
I mean, that might be nice.
Ever the silver lining. So what has the reaction been in Europe to all of this? Like, what has the response been, and to what extent is there one?
Yeah, so this is what's really interesting, I think. If you read the kind of European commentariat, there are two main thrusts to the takes that commentators have been coming out with off the back of this horrible, horrible week for US-Europe relations. And broadly, it is the pessimists versus the optimists. The pessimists are reacting to all of these developments by saying, Jesus Christ, we are screwed as a continent. You know, we Europeans can never agree about anything. The EU alone is made up of 27 governments that often pull in different directions. We're definitely not going to be able to launch any kind of coordinated response to losing the US as a strategic friend. Also, we are financially broke at the moment. So if we're going to be asked to spend billions more every year on defense because the US is leaving us alone to protect ourselves from Russia, we can't afford it. We're screwed. Oh, also our biggest economies, Germany and France, have extremely messy politics right now, and it's not really clear who's in charge. So you can forget about EU leaders managing to get on the same page about this and actually doing anything about it. So that is one camp, the negative Norberts, we can call them. The other camp is the optimists. What can we call them? The positive Paulines?
Positive Patricia.
Patricias, sure. They are saying, you know, Europe is forged in moments of crisis. Just look at COVID. We managed to launch some pretty decent joint initiatives when it came to getting everyone vaccinated, propping up the economy. We can do this, guys. Chief among these optimists, I would say, is the French president, Emmanuel Macron. To his credit, Macron is annoying in many, many ways, but he has been warning for years and years now about how Europe needs what he calls strategic autonomy from the US. This idea that we can't always rely on the US having friendly governments that share our values. We need to build up our own defense, our own strategic industries, and we need to stop relying on American money to prop up the militaries on this continent. And he has been right about that the whole time. But no one really wanted to admit it because, frankly, we don't want to spend money on defense. And I get it, you know, like, I am a peace-loving person. I would much rather spend those extra percentage points of our GDP on education and reducing poverty and all of those other things. But I think this is really a moment where we have to be honest with ourselves as Europeans and say, okay, well, what is the threat of Russia attacking Europe beyond the horrors that it's already inflicted on Ukraine? And if the threat is as serious as we think it is, what are we going to do about it? So Macron, you know how he loves being the guy in Europe who gets everyone together. He hosted lots of European leaders for emergency talks in Paris on Monday. Not all EU leaders, which some of them were understandably pissed off about, but they met. And the clearest message coming out of these talks was, okay, yes, we agree. We need to increase our own defense spending. Nothing concrete. There was no specific number of billions coming out of these talks. But, you know, this was one day of talks that was more about getting the conversation started than anything else. And it was interesting to hear Germany specifically talking about whether they might be able to change the debt rules to make it easier to spend money on defense. Because as we all know, Germany has historically been very into this idea of keeping a careful eye on spending and often lecturing other Europeans for supposedly not doing this. So if Germany does, as suggested, end up borrowing a bunch of money to spend more on defense, that would be a very big deal. What's also interesting is that you've seen over the last couple of days a few countries coming forward and saying we would be willing to send troops to Ukraine as peacekeepers if there was some kind of peace deal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty big. And this would be to make sure that Russia doesn't go against the terms of any hypothetical peace deal and start invading more territory again. Notably, the UK has said that it would send troops. Sweden has said maybe. And France, behind the scenes, seems like it would do it. They've certainly talked about it previously. And this is really important because for all we know, Trump might meet with Putin and say, I've negotiated a fantastic peace deal, best deal ever. And that peace deal could be totally on Putin's terms. Because everything we've seen from Trump is that he doesn't really care about securing a solution for Ukraine that is just. He just wants to be able to go back to his base and say, you see, I told you I could fix Ukraine. And then he wants to get out of there because he does not care about Ukraine. He doesn't particularly care about restraining Russia in general from stomping across Europe. If anything, it's frightening to say it, but Trump sees a lot to admire in this authoritarian leader who, you know, like him, has declared war on wokeism and wants to defend Christian values, masculine values.
Oh my God, when can we just have 100 years of women running the country or the world and just see what happens? I mean, come on.
Well, I really want to talk in a future episode about Iceland because politics there seems to be pretty much entirely female right now. I'm very intrigued to see what happens in the next couple of years. But let's save that for a future podcast.
Like, I'm willing to admit it may not be perfect, but come on, it's not going very well.
It's not going great, guys. But anyway, Trump could say to Ukraine, you know, there is a peace deal on the table, take it or leave it. And Ukraine might say, well, hang on a second, under the terms of this deal, we have had a bunch of our territory permanently taken away. We're also never allowed to join NATO, which would protect us from a future attack. There's also very good reason not to trust Putin if he says that he would be content with just having these little bits of extra territory, because he has said over and over and over again that he believes the whole of Ukraine should belong to Russia. And the US could say, well, you know, to us, this deal looks pretty decent. So if you don't want it, Ukraine, we are not going to support you anymore at all. We are out. And if that happens, Europe needs to be there to be able to step in if we are serious about standing up for ourselves and standing up for our own security. Because this is the thing, Ukraine's security is our security. If we don't stop Putin from stomping on Ukraine, where does he stop? Does he go further? This isn't just about helping out a friend. It's actually in our own interest to help defend Ukraine. And, you know, some of the more feisty commentators have been pointing out over the last week that economically, we do have the might to take on Russia without the US. The EU's economy is way bigger than Russia's. And even if you take out the US, NATO countries together have about twice the number of bodies in their armed forces as Russia does. So this is a question of willingness more than anything. And, you know, it's funny, all of the attention at this Munich security conference was on J.D. Vance and his appalling speech. But there was also another speech that I think got way less attention than it deserved, which was the speech by the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. And something he said that was really interesting is that this isn't really about spending more money on defense, or it's not just about that. What we really need is a change of mindset in Europe. We have felt safe for so long, especially, you know, the further west you go on this continent, Europeans are just not in the habit of thinking about our safety, full stop.
Yeah, I think that's just so wild. Also because, like, I, until the past few years, never thought about safety. I live in the Netherlands. It's like really the furthest west you can go almost. And like, it's just wild because both of my grandparents grew up in occupations and war, and I just don't understand how quickly that's gone.
Yeah.
But anyway, apparently it can also move quickly in the opposite direction.
This is not just about increasing defense spending as a GDP ratio. Money is needed, of course, yes, but money alone will not stop an enemy assault. People and weapons don't come for free. But again, it's not just about budgets. It's about people realizing the need to defend their own home.
Katie, as you say, we are 27 countries within the EU alone, mm-hmm. and Europe is also bigger than that. Do the negative Norberts not have a point when they say that getting us to pull in the same direction is really quite hard?
Yeah, it is really hard. And within the EU alone, you know, we have a bunch of national leaders who actively align with Trump, the Orbans and the Fizzos and the Malonis. Mm. I mean, Maloney's a bit of a tricky one because she's far right, but also pro-Ukraine. So it'll be interesting to see how she positions herself on all of this. Zelensky said in his speech that it was time for Europe to have its own united army. It feels really clear that there are a lot of leaders in Europe right now who would answer that with, you know, you've got to be kidding. I mean, look, there has been increasing talk in recent years of a need for a two-speed Europe, like a set of countries that want to integrate more and faster and act together on the world stage, and a set of countries who are less interested in that. I wonder if we might be headed less for a Europe of two speeds, but a Europe of two different value sets, like one set of countries that carries on defending what we think of today as European values, like, you know, having properly independent courts, a free media that isn't just government propaganda, protecting minorities, that kind of thing. And then we might have another more Trumpy set of countries that are in the EU, maybe, and we can't really do anything about that. They're there already. But we just kind of leave them to do their own thing. I think we are going to have to be pragmatic about that. And this path forward for, you know, better defending ourselves without US help, potentially helping Ukraine to seek the future that it wants, that is going to have to be a coalition of the willing that does that. It won't include governments on the inside of the EU that have like pro-Russian leanings, like Hungary's. And it might include countries that are on the outside of the EU but do share the same values, like the UK. Macron already started setting something like this up a couple of years ago. Remember that he set up this thing called the European Political Community? Maybe that's a place where this could start happening. I mean, look, I think we're just going to have to be flexible and also remember that nothing is permanent.
Flexible / utterly surrender to the many unknowns.
We'll do what we can. But I think we also need to remember that nothing is permanent. For all we know, there might be a reasonable government back in the White House in 4 years' time. There might also be an even more scary, unreasonable one. And we should plan for that. But it's a very weird time for this relationship that has been so important for Europe for such a long time. It really feels like things have gone topsy-turvy in the past week. Like, you've got European liberals who used to love America suddenly talking in terms of sovereignty and independence. And then you've got far-right Europeans who used to use that kind of language, now apparently seeming very comfortable with the idea of cozying up with this foreign power and being dependent on it. It's a very, very weird time.
Yeah, I also wonder if we need to start accepting that it's not so much these countries versus those countries, and that all of those opinions and value systems are inside each of our countries in varying degrees. I don't know if that would help anything, but that's something that comes up in me.
We absolutely have to recognize that if you look at the way that politics is going in so many countries. It's very true. On that cheery note, should we move on to Good Week? Who's had a good week, Kat?
So this is a classically caveated good week. It's not necessarily a great week for those that enjoy alcohol, nor the alcohol lobby.
Aww.
But it's a good week for European livers.
Good week for our livers. Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, I have to admit that this is more like it used to be worse for European livers than a real solid good week.
You know what? This week I'll take it.
All right. Drum roll. The WHO called for the European alcohol labels to include a warning for cancer, much like tobacco.
Woohoo! This is your big cause for celebration. Oh, this is the good week.
Sorry.
Why is this happening now in a week where we all should be drinking more, in my opinion.
Well, maybe you'll feel differently at the end of this segment. Yeah. So this was spurred on after a survey found that the vast majority of Europeans have absolutely no idea about the connections between alcohol and cancer.
I feel like that includes me, to be honest.
Yeah, I think it also until recently included me. When you think about like the risks of drinking, what comes up?
Probably like liver disease, maybe heart disease.
Yeah, lots of people say driving, but you're actually way more likely to die from alcohol-induced cancer than in an alcohol-induced car accident. Mm. The WHO was alarmed when they found out that only 15% of Europeans know about the link between alcohol and breast cancer, which is in spite of the fact that 800,000 Europeans die per year because of alcohol-related cancer.
Wow. I genuinely had no idea about that.
I know, I had no idea. And of the women who die, 60% is from breast cancer.
God, related to alcohol.
I know, I find it absolutely wild. And in the general population's defense and in our defense, it's not super surprising that we don't know about this because only three EU countries have health warnings on alcohol. And Ireland is actually the first country in Europe that will require specific cancer warnings, but that's only starting in 2026.
Oh, yeah. We talked about this on the show, didn't we? Like a long time ago, I think.
Yeah, there was strife because Italy got upset that the wine was being bashed.
Yes. So I don't know if you're even able to tell me this, but like how much extra risk do I face of getting cancer if I drink too much?
Yeah, so it varies quite a lot depending on like how much you drink, your genetics, all these other variables. And as we know from other toxins, the alcohol lobby has really used this fact that it's quite difficult to make this super direct connection of like this person definitely has cancer because of their drinking. Mm. But it turns out that even low level and moderate drinking causes measurable risks. One representative from the WHO put it like this: we cannot talk about so-called safe level of alcohol use. It doesn't matter how much you drink. The risk to the drinker's health starts at the very first drop of any alcoholic beverage.
Boo.
I know. The only thing we can say for sure is that the more you drink, the more harmful it is. But then in other words, the less you drink, the safer it is. Yeah. So, Katie, what do you think is low and moderate?
Oh, what's a low amount of drinking?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Macron has 2 glasses a day and he considers that to be reasonable. I'm going to say that, like, presumably not every day is good. I'm going to say, like, 4 glasses of wine a week. I call that moderate. But I am French.
Yeah. So it's changed quite a lot in recent years. But right now, moderate drinking is considered to be 1 drink a day and low drinking is 1 or 2 drinks a week. And depending on the study, it turns out that just 1 drink a day increases a woman's risk of breast cancer by 10 to 22%.
Wow.
And that even 1 drink a week can increase her risk by 4%. In men, there are quite comparable risks of colon cancer. And according to the US general surgeon last year, actually, moderate drinking raises your chance of mouth cancer by a whopping 40%. I just wow. Find that astonishing. I had no idea.
Yeah, I just think most of us don't draw that connection, right? Like you maybe think smoking and mouth cancer, but not drinking and mouth cancer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I'm loving this conversation, obviously, Kat. apart from exposing myself to greater cancer risks by drinking, what other risks are we talking about here that maybe we don't think about so often?
Yeah, honestly, it affects almost everything.
Oh, great.
The main mechanism is that alcohol affects your DNA, which is why it has so many different health risks.
It affects my DNA?
Yeah, it damages your DNA. And so any level of alcohol increases your risk of heart issues, of liver functioning, aging skin, the size of your brain. Now that I have spent a few minutes totally freaking you all out, I will say these risks are all averages and it's still marginal, right? Like you're still unlikely to get any of these fatal diseases because of a glass of wine a week.
Mm-hmm.
And like everything we do in life seems to have a risk. But I think these facts are really important to challenge the prevailing story we have around alcohol. 1 drink a day knocks off 3 months of your life expectancy. And if that doesn't sound huge or like difficult to understand, then maybe we should make that comparison with cigarettes. The risk of early death caused by 1 cigarette a day is the same as 1 drink a day.
So can I have one of each?
I don't know what to say to that.
No, sorry, that's bad maths.
And if you drink 2 to 4 drinks a day, that's 10 to 15 cigarettes a day. So I think what our sense of normal is just like really not at all in line with the facts. Another thing that strikes me about this story is something that Dominic pointed out when we were talking about prepping the show. I think Europeans think that our relationship to alcohol is similar to the rest of the world, but it really isn't. We're home to the heaviest drinkers in the world. The average European above the age of 15 drinks 9.5 liters of pure alcohol a year. Mm. There's quite a bit of variation. And the good news is that alcohol consumption in Europe has dropped by 21% between 2000 and 2019.
Yeah, I was going to say it feels certainly amongst my circle like it's down and, you know, more people are doing Dry January and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also really a lot less popular amongst the Gen Zers. So it is worth noting that it's going down, but it's also worth noting that it's really remarkably a lot lower in the rest of the world. One reason is that in Muslim countries, it's also just really a lot lower. Mm-hmm. But where our average is 9.5 liters, more than half of African countries average at close to 0 liters per year. And most of Asia is also about half.
Wow. You know, it's no secret that our continent enjoys a drink. Like, I live in France where wine is basically a religion. But yeah, I don't really think that often about how different that culture of alcohol is compared to different parts of the world. You mentioned this already that Gen Zers, loads of them basically don't drink at all. You're not quite a Gen Z. I think you're technically a young millennial, right? You're a good few years younger than me though. What's your own relationship with drinking? Are you one of these people that's just basically stopped doing it?
Yeah, it's actually really shifted quite a lot in the past few years, which happened because 2 years ago, I couldn't drink for like 8 months because of something medical. Uh-huh. And that just really fundamentally changed something. I grew up in Spain, as you know, and I was like actively encouraged to drink wine from 12. And in retrospect, I drank really quite a lot in my teenage years, like almost every day. And it would make me feel all grown up. And I loved that the adults like let me be a grown up. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it was particularly strange, but it's quite shocking in retrospect. And I mean, before I started drinking less, like no one talked to me about the fact that I might have an alcohol problem, but daily drinking was definitely very casual. So when this doctor asked me like, oh, so you won't be able to drink for the next half a year, is that going to be a problem? I had this weird confronting moment where I was like, oh, that is something I'm going to notice. Like I'm going to have to make an effort here. Which was really a moment where I thought, wow, this is maybe a bigger deal than I realized because it's just so socially accepted. Mm. In the time since that, I've come to drink way less. But I'm wondering how that is for you after being pregnant.
Well, I can certainly say that as the parent of a very small person, there are many evenings where I'm like, God, I could do with a glass of wine.
Fair enough.
But it's funny because I feel like the culture here is also changing quite a lot here in France. Like, as I said, there are more people doing Dry January, even though as an initiative, it is not supported by the government, kind of hilariously.
Like actively not?
Well, actively not, yeah. Which may or may not have something to do with the fact that this is a wine producing country. So booze is economically important and the wine lobby is really powerful. But yeah, the culture of booze in France does feel generally like it is diminishing. Like it's very rare now to see like anyone having wine at lunch, at least in a work canteen, maybe in a restaurant they would. But if you look at like, you know, the number of fun non-alcoholic drinks available on like the menu of a bar, it's way more than it was a few years ago. So stuff is shifting in general, I think.
Yeah, it really is. And I will say I've gone back to drinking occasionally, but I do really notice the difference, like just my energy levels and stuff like that. And it's quite cool how quick that goes. I find that quite motivating. Mm. I really notice so much more of a difference than I expected. And I also remember, didn't you tell me that your husband stopped drinking out of solidarity and then he was like subtly glowing in his skin?
Yes, he had a pregnant glow.
I love that. So join your husband. One bad thing I'd like to close on is that I learned that up until the 50s, children in France were served multiple glasses of wine at lunch as a national policy.
Yes, until the 50s. At school!
That is so wild. The photos are both hilarious and really quite disturbing. But well, I just wanted to say that to emphasize there's clearly room to change on what we think is normal. Sorry it wasn't so jolly, but yay for all of our livers.
Good job, livers. we have some lovely new supporters to thank this week for keeping this podcast in existence by throwing a few coins our way every month so that, yeah, the show can remain free to listen to for everyone who can't afford to support us financially. Who are we thanking this week, Kat?
We are thanking Dan, Baya and Sue. Thank you so much for supporting our show.
Thank you so much to all three of you and to everyone who supported the show to keep us in your ears for the past 7 years now, which is kind of unbelievable for a podcaster.
We're so old.
We are very old.
It's like 100 in podcast years.
But it's kind of unbelievable for a podcast that isn't put out by a big media organization to survive that long. And it's all thanks to you. If you would like to help keep us in business, we would love it if you consider joining these generous supporters. Any amount you can afford, big or small, is a huge help. And you can find all of the information at patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. Does it make you proud, Kat, to come from the country that birthed reality television?
So proud.
Like, I didn't even know until Dominic told me that the Netherlands was the birthplace of so many of these reality TV shows that became so huge in the 90s. Big Brother is the most iconic example of a Dutch reality TV show, of course. Did you grow up watching that, or had it already gone kind of out of fashion by the time you were a teenager?
No, not at all. It was around, but I just didn't watch it.
Too cool for that.
I was watching other very bad television.
A more recent TV format that originally came from the Netherlands that has since become insanely successful is The Traitors, De Verraders. Have you watched it?
I haven't. I have heard about it though.
Yeah, my family-in-law are obsessed with the UK version. If you haven't heard of it, it is a reality show based on this kids' game where a few of you are quote-unquote traitors whose job is to destroy the majority. I feel like this game has maybe become an allegory for the politics of our time. Anyway, it is basically a game where you have to lie and backstab. And apparently it works super well on television because if you don't already have a version of this TV show in a country near you, you probably will do soon. Versions of the show have recently been announced for Spain, for Italy, for Romania, and for South Africa. And new ones seem to be popping up all the time. But yeah, I find this phenomenon of TV formats that cross borders to be completely fascinating. Like, how does the business work? What are the pitfalls of trying to translate a TV format from one culture to another? I have many questions and I found the perfect person to ask them to. Jean Chalabi is a professor of international communication at City University London. He literally wrote the book about the TV formats trade. I gave him a ring to find out more. Jean, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
So what exactly is the history of this phenomenon? When did people watching TV in one country first start being presented with shows in formats that had originated in another country?
Oh, I think I've got an exact date for you. It's 1951. Mm-hmm. And the first broadcaster to purchase the format was the BBC for a CBS show called What's My Line? And what was new is that CBS or the CBS right holders didn't sell a script. They sold what they called a package, an idea. Most formats in 1950s, 1960s, 1970s were US game shows. So in the 1980s, The Wheel of Fortune, The Price is Right became really the first, I would say, near global formats that were broadcast in many, many countries, not globally, but in a lot of countries. There are a few European formats. Les Jeux sans frontières, it was a very famous show when I was a kid in Switzerland.
Games Without Borders. What was the idea behind that show?
I think it was different towns and different villages, maybe, were competing each other in a series of physical games. So you had a few British formats, you had a few French formats, Italian formats, but most of them were American, 1970s, 1980s. And then in the late 90s came really the revolution, which was reality television. Mm. You had Survivor, which was basically bumps on the beach. You had Big Brother, which is still on in certain territories and has a lot of successors through Love Island, which is quite big now. You can trace the origins of Love Island to Big Brother, basically. And then you have Idols. So Idols was started in the UK and became huge in the US, attracting tens of millions of viewers. Before the 90s, very few TV executives knew what a format was. And after the 90s, everybody knew what a format was.
And what was it about these shows that were appearing in the 90s that made this such a phenomenon?
In a game show, what is a game show? It's a journey. Okay, it's a journey of a hero. It's someone like you and me who has the courage to take a test. What makes it compelling in this person, this hero, is someone like you and me. Mm. Is it always asked the question is, what will you do with the money? People identify with this. And the good answer is not, I will give it to charity. Nobody believes this. The good answer is, I want a new car. I want a kitchen extension. You identify with these people. So because you identify with these people need to come from your own culture and need to speak your own language. Now, that's the key to the format, but because the person has to be local.
You say that, but you know, I'm slightly ashamed to admit this, but lately I have dabbled in watching this Netflix show called Love is Blind. And after I started watching this show, I started getting loads of different national versions of this show being suggested on my Netflix front page, like Love is Blind Germany, Love is Blind Brazil. So I'm wondering, has the rise of streaming platforms like Netflix, has that changed the sense that the hero has to be local?
Yeah, I think Netflix will be more known for dramas as they do a little bit of reality television. I think I have to say streamers have not been very kind to the format trade because they have a transnational audience. And the way they operate is that they like to make local content travel. They commission a drama in France, like in Marseille or whatever. It's French, but it's French for export. The format trade is mostly for broadcasters because broadcasters have a national audience. I would say most formats, it's kind of daytime television. Streamers have them some formats, but mostly streamers lack the content to travel.
And for those broadcasters, the trade in formats has clearly become a very big business. Can you give me an idea of how big a business this is?
A good format would travel towards 20, 30, 40 territories, but I do not have a figure now because the trade, you're going to pay a percentage of production cost. I mean, Koh-Lanta would make cost €500,000 to produce every episode. The format fees would be 8% or 15% of this. But it's a big trade. All the big production companies like BBC Studios, ITV Studios, Banijay, which is based in France, would have a few thousand formats in the catalogs.
Wow.
Quantifying it in euros or dollars is difficult. In the mid-2010s, it was €3 billion. But I don't know how it was calculated. I suspect they took all the production costs, whereas in fact, a more accurate description would, you have to talk the format fee. So if you want to produce The Traitors, for instance, in France, you'd go to whoever owns The Traitors. I think it's All3Media. And they would give you the production Bible with all the secrets, how you produce this show.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this. So let's say I come up with a genius idea for a TV format. How would I go about making loads of money by selling it to different countries?
Mostly, you need, if you're in France, you need to sell it to a French broadcaster. So the selling point is, look, I sold this format to France Télévisions. And France Television, with my format, used to have 15% of audience at 3 p.m. And with my format, they had 19% of the audience. And if you can show this have increased the performance in terms of audience percentage, you have a winner.
And are there any examples of TV companies basically stealing ideas for formats that exist already in other countries and saying, oh, you know, we didn't steal this idea. We didn't borrow it. We came up with this ourselves. It was our own idea.
Yeah, it does happen a lot. So there is an association called FRAPA, and you can go to FRAPA. I can't remember what it stands for. It's the trade association in the format world. And yeah, copyright infringement can be quite frequent. Mm-hmm. And most of these things are settled out of court because the courts, I think they've got more serious cases to look at. I'm not saying it's not taken seriously, but it's not top of the pile.
Are there any countries that are particularly great at coming up with formats? Like, I feel like a lot of the most successful formats have come from the Netherlands, they've come from the UK. You know, these are not massive countries. Is there any reason why they're particularly good at this?
Yeah, no, I mean, you mentioned two of the biggest producers. I could add maybe Korea. The UK was number one format producer. Okay, the reason for this is very simple, is that the UK was the first country in Europe to disaggregate the television value chain, meaning by this, you have broadcasters who broadcast and a huge production sector whose job is to come up with format ideas.
I see. So they were like private companies battling to compete for having really good ideas.
Exactly. So Channel 4, I would say, was a typical example. By law, could not produce anything. So everything you had on Channel 4 would be outsourced to these independent producers. We often would specialize in a genre, whether scripted or unscripted, drama or game shows or reality. That's why these countries are very good. And Netherlands would be the same.
Interesting. So once a TV format has been acquired in a new country, how does a TV company go about adapting the format for a local market and the local culture?
So they pay a fee, is they pay a production fee, and they would have access to the, what we call the production Bible. A document that is very confidential, it's hundreds of pages, and they give you all the do's and the don'ts of the format. And it's kind of subtle. It gives you a lot of secrets. They tell you how to make it work. Reverse engineering is more difficult than it looks. So if you can see a format like Britain's Got Talent, for instance, because I want to do the same in my country, it'd be very difficult because behind the format, there is a lot of knowledge and expertise, what you do at certain stage of the production, how you prepare for it, how you get the contestants, so on and so forth. So every format will have some secrets that are not shared, and you need them to make this show a success.
Are there any examples of shows that have actually ended up being quite different or feeling quite different in one country compared to the original because the local company thought that the domestic audience would prefer it a certain way?
The answer depends on the genre. So with game shows, no, because it's very much controlled. If you watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, anywhere in the world, you're going to recognize this as millionaire. You have to buy the graphic, the music, and the Bible is very, very specific. What changed a lot, sometimes you have to rewrite the stories for drama. One example is Swedish The Bridge, the story of a body found at the border between, I think, Sweden and Denmark. And then they did a version in the UK, and it was the tunnel. It was under sous la Manche.
So the channel tunnel between France and the UK.
So yeah, some in drama, you may have to completely rescript the entire thing. But what you take is you take the internal dynamic. I mean, a very successful show in the UK was Fawlty Towers. As they tried to do it in the US, it was a complete failure because what is at the core of Fawlty Towers is a dysfunctional marriage. So if you take this idea out of Fawlty Towers, you don't have Fawlty Towers. The core idea has to stay the same. And for The Bridge, I guess it's the collaboration between two police forces with different cultures. So you can do it anywhere. You can do it between the US and Mexico if you want. But the core principle would be two police forces who have different ways of operating have to collaborate to solve this murder mystery.
Are there any examples of formats that have been really successful in the original country and then once they are exported, it's just bombed? Or maybe examples of the opposite, a format that hasn't been that successful at home and then it's been exported and it's done really well.
Yes, so Survivor is one. In the UK, that was 25 years ago, and gone absolutely nowhere. So now we have something different in the UK. It's called I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. But Survivor has never been successful in the UK. Been successful in a lot of countries, about 50 countries. And in France, it's Koh-Lanta, it's part of French television culture. I mean,
it's huge.
Now it's a French format because owned by Banny J.
Why do you think it didn't work in the UK?
Yeah, it's a mystery. I mean, you need to be close to the national psyche. Maybe in the UK, they want something more, less competitive. sometimes you got technical explanations, but I don't believe in them, about scheduling. I think it was the wrong time, the wrong day, or maybe the competition was very strong on that particular day. I think that, yeah, the question is deeper. And then formats that haven't worked very well, I think The Apprentice. I think the first version was the US, I think, with Donald Trump, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. And they tried, and of course, you need someone with certain characteristics to make it work. I know it hasn't been successful everywhere, and particularly in Germany. Yeah, you need a certain person to do this with a certain charisma. So, but yeah, of course, formats die all the time and they can be revived.
Something I love about watching a format that is familiar from your own country in a new country is like noticing the slight differences between them. Mm. There's a French friend of mine who watched for the first time the original version of the Great British Bake Off. She's obviously much more familiar with the French version, which is called Meilleur Pâtissier, and it's quite similar. It does have this kind of cozy feel, but it's also a bit more serious as a competition. And she was like quite horrified by the quality of the cakes on the British version. She was just like, oh my God, your cakes are so untidy. It's just very rude.
Something that's coming up in me that I'm wondering now if it's a fake memory. I have these memories of sitting in Barcelona in the dentist and seeing Catalan Pingu. And in my memory, I'm like, surprised that Pingu speaks Catalan because Pingu in England didn't say anything. I have no idea if this is true. So rather than fact checking it, because some Catalans write in and tell me Pingu is speaking in Catalan.
I just love the idea of Pingu like having Duolingo and learning Catalan in the Antarctic.
I know. I'm also just, if this is true rather than a fake memory, like imagine the Catalan script writers just making up an entire script that was not originally written.
And he's really like sassy and sarcastic.
Exactly.
Love this idea. Thank you so much to Jean for enlightening me about the whole world of TV formats. I would love to hear about your experiences of TV formats that have arrived in your country and have either worked super well or have mystified people and been a total flop. Write in and tell me. hello@europeanspodcast.com. Kat, what have you been enjoying recently?
Well, Katie, I'm actually going to do some producer solidarity. And instead of giving you my tip, I'm going to pass it on to Morgan, producer of the show, because I think she has an excellent tip.
Morgan here. Hi. We haven't talked very much about the demonstrations that have been going on in Slovakia since the end of last year, responding to Prime Minister Robert Fico's kind of cozy relationship with Moscow and also his refusal to provide aid to Ukraine. But in light of the fact that those protests have gotten even bigger recently, but also in response to Katz's call for a world led by women, I wanted to recommend a documentary that came out a few months ago. It's called Prezidentka. In English, the title is Ms. President. And it's about Slovakia's former president, Zuzana Čaputová, who not only led Slovakia through COVID-19 and the start of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, but also who took office just a few days after her daughter was diagnosed with a brain tumor. The movie is incredibly gripping and emotionally moving, and I'm not going to tell you too much, but it all sort of begins with a series of clips from a Slovak presidential debate where, you know, one candidate after another gets up and expresses the same kind of frightening right-wing rhetoric that, of course, we're all becoming familiar with. And then Čaputová takes the mic, and she offers this vision of tolerance for other people and respect for the environment. And, you know, spoiler alert, she wins. And watching it, it's almost hard to believe that she was president so recently, now that, you know, the values of open-mindedness and open-heartedness seem, you know, frankly, unwelcome on the world stage. And, of course, the film itself becomes a kind of heartbreaking farce. But I think this is a week when we could all stand to envision more of what we'd like to see in Europe and on the planet, and not just necessarily what we'd like to fight against. And that's what Chaputova did for me while I was watching the documentary. So anyway, the film is called Prezidentka or Ms. President, and it might be a little bit hard to find outside of Slovakia and the Czech Republic, but I think it's definitely worth keeping an eye out for.
Sounds great. Can't wait to check it out.
Yeah. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
I watched a gorgeous film over the weekend made by the Vietnamese-French director Tran Anh Hung, who is kind of seen as being at the forefront of the rise of like fancy international Vietnamese cinema, I guess you could say, over the past couple of decades. His first films were all set in Vietnam. This one is set in France, where he moved with his family at the age of 12. And it is beautiful. It is called The Taste of Things. In French, it's called La Passion de Doudon Bouffant. It came out in 2023, I think. And it's a period drama set in the 1880s. It stars Juliette Binoche as an incredibly talented cook who works in this kind of grand chateau. And she and her boss, Mr. Aristocrat, they've been in a relationship for maybe 20 years. He has repeatedly asked her to marry him during this time, but she doesn't want to because she feels like she would have less power in their relationship if they were married. Hmm. So it's kind of a film about these like complicated power dynamics in a relationship between a man and a woman from very different social classes in the 19th century. It's also a very beautiful portrayal of love in the autumn of people's lives, as the film puts it. But more than anything, this is a film for greedy people because both of the main characters, Eugénie and Doudin, they are absolute food obsessives. And the lavishness of the cooking scenes in this film, it's just mouthwatering. The way that they talk about food is bordering on comical, especially if, how can I put this? If you have spent a lot of time around French people in your life, you'll probably have sat through conversations where they'll spend like 10 to 15 minutes describing in great detail a single thing that they ate yesterday.
One of my favorite things about French people.
It's both very endearing and incredibly boring because it's like, oh, in this case, there is some truth to this national stereotype. You guys really are obsessed with food. So it's quite funny and lovely to see this in a period drama set like 150 years ago. It's set around the dawn of haute cuisine and the elevation of French cooking as a kind of art form, really. So if you are someone who loves food and loves cooking, you will probably get a kick out of watching the slightly mad way in which the characters in this film approach food as like the single greatest pleasure of life, I guess. But yeah, it is also, as I say, a very moving film about love in later life. And it is visually gorgeous. Literally every shot looks like a Renoir painting or something. So yeah, if you're looking for something to feast your eyes on, I really recommend this film. It is called The Taste of Things.
That sounds great. And thanks for giving us something to enjoy after I've lectured you all about alcohol.
I'm sure the World Health Organization would not like this man's cooking. There's quite a lot of butter involved.
Fuck it. All right, Katie, I have an actual legit happy ending for you.
Thank you. I need one.
Yeah. I am taking you to Slovenia, your favorite country in Europe.
It is.
Not that we have favorites here at the Europeans.
I do.
Okay, fine. I do too. But yeah, a group of Slovenian scientists have made some big discoveries about the complexity of the courtship songs made by crickets.
Ooh.
By the way, I think it's so funny that we still talk about animal communication with words like courtship, like they're all still living in the 1600s.
It's nice. I'm imagining them bowing to each other.
I know. Like, where are the situationships and the love bombing of the crickets? but anyway, this is a classic example of humans being totally surprised that once again, we have vastly underestimated our fellow species. This study was a deep dive into the vibroacoustic performance, or in simpler words, the singing and dancing of male crickets when they're trying to seduce females. It turns out it is way more complicated than we thought. So like that classic wing rubbing sound that you hear in summer nights, that is just the beginning. The male crickets are also swaying their bodies and drumming on the ground with their little tiny legs and making incredibly complicated vibrations that are inaudible to our human ears. But it is a very important part of how crickets choose their lovers. The scientists pointed out that loads of species communicate via vibrations, which is something we're only just starting to tune into because we have the technology to. So there's this whole new universe opening up to us. They converted those vibrations into a sound that is audible to us. Do you want to have a listen? Now, as you know, animal communication is one of my favorite subjects. Whales also have this crazy acoustic scanning system where they sort of send out these sonic pulses to be able to see what's around them.
Mm.
And we're really just figuring that out. And something this whale scientist pointed out was that a few sex-obsessed man scientists in the 1600s led us to believe that all animal communication is about mating. And obviously the sound I just played to you today is a mating song, as far as we know. But that just opened up this whole new world for me that, of course, animals are communicating about so much more. Like another bird communication scientist pointed out that it's really very unlikely that birds are just doing mating songs and the rest of their sounds are random. Like they're not just walking around being like doop, 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 doop. that would just be like a lot of energy.
Yeah, presumably a lot of it is like, hey guys, there's really good worms over here or something.
Yeah, and I mean, who knows? Like they're communicating about a whole bunch of things, and this is just one of the only technological advances that I'm really very excited about. Like, what are we going to learn that animals are communicating about just in our lifetimes? It's moving really quickly.
Mm.
And maybe they're talking about things we haven't even thought to think about. And I think that's really, really, really exciting. So I cannot wait for the years to come and all of the sounds and things we will learn.
This weekend, there is a rather crucial election happening in Germany, which we are awaiting with quite a lot of anxiety, it's fair to say. So next week, we're going to be bringing you a bit of a special episode focused primarily on those big elections in Germany and trying to make sense of the results. Don't miss it. In the meantime, of course, you can find us on social media. Where can people find us, Kat?
They can find us on Instagram at Europeans Podcast. They can find us on Blue Sky still.
Yeah.
Also on Mastodon. And we're not on Threads anymore, are we?
Nah, we don't like it there anymore. Oh, but we are on YouTube, where I'm pleased to say you can watch a video of Dominic and me breaking down key moments from the
it's so good.
The slightly mad laser show that the European Commission staged last week to celebrate the Baltic countries joining the European electricity grid. Fun times. Just type in Europeans Podcast.
I just cannot believe that happened.
It was a real trip. We were produced this week by Morgan Childs and by me. Thank you, Morgan. And thank you, me. And thank you, Kat, for joining us this week.
Thank you, Katie and Morgan.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Do we?
Bye.